This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about COVID PTSD with Dr. William Hasseltine. And it's worth saying right off the top that this is not something in terms of COVID PTSD that is currently diagnosable, nor is it something that today's guest is specifically pushing for as a separate condition to be diagnosable. Instead, this should be something that, reflecting on his work in the pandemic as a scientist and someone that's been tracking the effects on mental health very closely, instead, how can we fold in additional symptoms that the pandemic will cause and additional people that will have PTSD because of this specific trauma? How can we make sure that they are going to still be diagnosed and this is going to be recognised? The trauma that I think all of us are feeling to different degrees.
You know, it was great to have him on in that for that particular reason. I think you've just explained that really well, because there is a difference. And also, you know, there are people out there who have been aware that this would need to be tracked right from the beginning, just to be able to measure it. So that, because I guess at the moment we're all in this, these conversations that I'm having at the moment is with so many people saying, you know, because after COVID, and then others will go, there won't be an after COVID. And there's this whole debate at the moment, like we're still kind of waiting for it to end, even though restrictions have lifted and people are kind of getting back out to where they should be. The virus is still around and may always be. So there's so much work to be done from a, you know, research point of view around all this, and it's ongoing now. So it was really great to hear his understanding and his experiences to date and the work that he's doing.
And I won't give any spoilers for the episode, but the listeners will hear just how early on he was tracking this. Yeah. And the involvement he had before many of us were even aware, had even heard of COVID-19. So it's fascinating from that point of view to hear about the science of the spread, but also get another perspective on how much difference the restrictions have made, and particularly vaccinations, you know, a reminder of how vital they are. And, you know, we're both fully vaccinated. And I think we talked about on the show previously how we were feeling mentally safer. You know, there's that thing in your head, even as when you get the jab and you know that it's not fully effective immediately, you still, the action of going and getting it, you do feel safer.
Yeah, you do, yes. And even this morning, I had an email from a netball coach who'd been on the opposing team to my daughter yesterday to say one of the players had a positive test of COVID this morning, and they're 10 and 11 years old. I just thought, well, that's okay. I'm fully vaccinated. Ella's a child. 6 months ago, she'd have been off school, we'd have had to let everybody know, you know, this is the whole thing is just like moved on. And it did make me think about how I reacted to that information and how it made me feel compared to how it would have made me feel, you know, months and months ago.
Yeah.
Completely different.
Yeah. And the whole focus, I think, has changed so much, because it's no longer as much an outlook of, you know, levels of restrictions and legality as it was. And so for me, I've definitely noticed my thinking around masks, for example, has become less about the risk of the virus, because I know the numbers are less. I know that I've got my double jab. Anyone that I'm interacting with that I know, then I know they do. And those that I don't know, they probably have had their jab. And so it sort of becomes slightly less about safety and more about ethics a little bit in my mind, I've noticed. And so certain things, like if I go into a coffee shop and all the staff have masks, then I will also wear a mask, because for me, I never like to think in a way that there's any kind of social hierarchy. You know, of course, when I'm going into stores and staff are wearing masks, I'll wear a mask as well, you know, because that might be a sign that they don't have all the screens up, or that some of them might be vulnerable. Obviously, you're seeing, I think, in more stores, some staff that are wearing them and some aren't. And so for me, I'm quite happy to hold off until staff in stores and public places aren't wearing them anymore. And also, for me, there's an element of until certain minorities aren't wearing them anymore. because there is that noticeable difference, particularly from Southeast Asian communities, where there is more mask wearing because of fears of violent repercussions and hate crimes that, thank God, are on the decline again. But there's still that increased risk because of this sort of very Trumpian, you know, China virus mentality that some people are holding on to. And so for me, it's become more about that of, you know, I'm going to continue. It's not a big inconvenience for me. And I'm happy to take the precaution. Do you know what I mean? As opposed to it being purely about the virus.
Yeah, it's kind of sweet. You're taking one for the team. Like, I was the first one to rip my mask off. And if I go into a store, which is rare, I must admit now that the whole, but you are where you're based is right in the city centre. So you're in and out of so many different stores that will have different policies from, you know, head office and all kind of things. You know, I'm a little bit more local and working at home at the moment. I kind of go into the same couple of stores that are local just to do what I'm doing. But my like local supermarket, for example, no one's got masks on, maybe one person, and that might be due to their own health risks as opposed to like a company policy. But you do notice now when people are wearing masks more than whereas before you noticed when they weren't, people be toughing and puffing, you know, because 90% of us are wearing masks and you're not. You know, if you're not bothered about wearing masks, think about the safety of others. You know, that was the rhetoric that we were hearing all the time. And now it's the other way around, like the minority are wearing masks. But when you see them, like you said, if all staff have to, it's almost a bit unfair then that the customers can just mingle in and out without them, I guess, when you look at it that way.
That's part of my thinking. And as someone that's done so much retail work in the past, and, you know, it still to an extent works in the service industry with some of my work, they're people that could have been my colleagues at any point in my life. So I think I'm very tuned into that. I notice that, I think I've said to you off air, I notice that really with like my parents, of like, I think there's a little bit of a gap between how long current elements of that work is for me versus them having not had a service industry job for a long, long time. And so even if we're just in a restaurant and someone's hovering by the table to weigh up if we are done with our food, I'll notice that and I'll tell them if we are or not, whereas my parents will be oblivious. So I think I'm sort of still very tuned into what it's like to work in those kind of roles.
Yeah.
And that's probably part of it. But yeah, but it's a good point that you make, because I definitely see the opposite of that. I do get weird looks, and I do get sometimes people that will keep their distance from me because they see me wearing a mask. Yeah. And I think that's fine. I'm like, if you're going to be a little bit extra far away from me, that's fine with me. It's no harm to it, is there? And yeah, and it's just the strange place we're in, isn't it? That we're all trying to sort of navigate this stuff. And in some ways it was easier when the rules were clear. So there is a stress of people that don't know which way to go, and there are people that would be more self-conscious than I am if they were getting weird looks from people. And so, you know, I think that's something we can all sort of try and check ourselves on. You were talking about, I think, in last episode of things, you know, to watch out of stigma. And I think this is a parallel where it's like there's times when we all might stare a little bit if someone's wearing a mask and we're trying to work it out. And actually, we don't need to.
No, I think you've made an absolutely right point, because as you were talking, I was checking myself and thinking, Dan, you might need to check your behaviour a little bit, or some of your judgments that are coming up. They don't last for very long, and I obviously never act on them, but there may be a few naturally that pop in and out. And I do check myself at the time, but hearing you talk now has made me think a little bit more about that. And you're right, I think we could all take a leaf out of that book. But you're also right in the point you meant about the stresses of not knowing which way to turn. And I think with our guest today and moving into thinking about, you know, post effects and what we might all start going through, we're now in an area where our mental health can be impacted by the fact that there's this real confusion. And when there were strict lines and we knew what was going on and we stayed in, yeah, we were a bit unsure of the unfamiliarity with that, but we knew what we were allowed to do and what we weren't allowed to do. And, you know, I've got family in hospital at the moment that we can't go in and visit, but there's people on the ward that then can come out of the ward to visit their husband or child that's come to visit them. Like, not child, what are you called if you're a child, but you're not a kid? Like, you know, a child, no, like somebody's parent, like you're an elderly person. So like me, like I'm my mother's daughter, but I'm not a child. Yeah. So, you know, family, let's just say friends and family, you can actually go out and see them outside of the ward. So whatever risks there are, it just seems to make no sense. And my family members quite stressed with that, because then you potentially could be bringing something back into the ward. So what's the difference of us going to visit them in the ward? We could wear masks and a screen and wash our hands, and it could even be ordered, you know, that we're not all just going in at the same time, even just one visitor. And that's made it quite, that's, you know, really had an impact on like stress levels of my family member that's already, you know, severely unwell. And then us as a family is still a pressure on our mental health.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've lost a lot of that kind of cohesion in lockdown one. I think a lot of people are almost nostalgic about in some ways, you know, and it was objectively horrific. But I think we've had so much else horrific happen since. The numbers got even worse, obviously, than they were at that point. And so sometimes I think people look back at that and they were like, well, you know, we were on the same page. We were scared. We didn't know what we were allowed to do. We were, you know, so tightly restricted, and yet we were following the same rules, and there was a certain level of cohesion. Not saying it's perfect.
But there was definitely a togetherness, definitely a community togetherness. I think 100% you're right that we all reconnected and stuck together in a moment of fear, that real fear and uncertainty. Now, emoji, head blowing off emoji, yeah.
And you're right about, you know, talking about hospitals, because it's far from over and there are still people dying. And, you know, many of those people that are dying are those that haven't had their vaccines. And, you know, it's a concern. And so you're getting that real contrast in your family of seeing the outside world being more normal than we've seen it in a long time. And then, you know, a hospital environment that parts of it, they're just as suited up as they've been throughout. And there's still so many restrictions for visitors. So there is that contrast. But one of the things we wanted to look at, just to round up our intro, we've got a few stats about how different countries are getting along, relevant to today's guest as well. So for the UK, it is 89.4% who have had their first jab and 81.8% who are considered fully vaccinated, according to the UK government. And those percentages are for people that are 16 plus. In Ireland, it is 92.1% who have had their first jab and 90% who are fully vaccinated. And that's from the Irish Times for people who are 18 plus. And in America, it is 65.8% who are fully vaccinated. And that's according to NPR, the National Public Radio Broadcaster there. And that again is 18 plus. And just a few quick things to note there. For America, obviously, we've just got the stat for fully vaccinated. It's very difficult to get it for how many people have had one jab. And that's partly because of how different states report their numbers. Also worth noting, which might be part of the reason why the two figures for Ireland are quite close together, there is a vaccine available there that is not available at all here in the UK. And that is the Janssen or Johnson & Johnson. It's also known as vaccine because it's just one dose. So a lot of young people in Ireland have had a single dose of that and are considered fully vaccinated.
Interesting that is actually 65% of the adult US population is slightly worrying that there's probably been so many stories that have just been spread that have been negative around the vaccine and the conspiracies around all of that. Is it that they need to get the shit together, or is it the people just not, they're just not happy, they're just not having it? Bit of both, maybe.
I guess it's a whole load of factors. In the same way, you know, the vaccination rates being so high in Ireland is for a number of factors, including a slow initial rollout. I also think certain elements, like needing to have a double jab in order to go and eat inside a restaurant, could be a motivator for some people. It's interesting at times as well, seeing the rhetoric here of, like, you know, people will be rioting in the streets if vaccine passports are introduced. And actually, there are many countries all over the world where different versions of that that exists. I know there are ethical elements to it as well, but it's interesting seeing those kind of comparisons. And I wonder how much of a difference it makes. Like, I guess that's the ethics you're weighing up, right? Between like individual freedoms and idea of like how people's medical records can be used and if they could be seen as discriminatory, the issues around that, versus also we want to keep everyone safe. And an environment like inside at a restaurant is higher risk than sitting outside at a restaurant. It's so much to weigh up. So I am not going to say I have the answers at all, but I agree. It is worrying, that statistic for America. And actually, whilst we were very much celebrating the change of administration, I feel like in the interest of balance, I should also say Joe Biden came in with a lot of targets, including 70% of people getting their first jab by Independence Day, and that was not achieved. And so there'll be all sorts of opinions on where the fault for that lies, whether it was to do with his administration on the previous one. But either way, there's clearly a long way still to go. So, yeah. So that was, sorry, that was a slightly more sobering note than we planned for. Actually, it is still objectively impressive, those percentages for a vaccine that even a year ago, we didn't know when that would be coming, if it would be coming.
Definitely. So positive. Even the way that it's been administered, I have to take my hat off to everybody. Every time, you know, I get a text message or your second jab is due, call your GP. Going in, we're there, we're lining up. Every GP's got this marquee outside. We're all ordered. We know what we're doing. We're so bloody lucky in this country that we've got that sophistication and that, and the money and the, you know, ingenuity to be able to deliver this huge, what's the word, Bob?
Operation.
Yeah, I just think it's brilliant. I really, really do. And, you know, I just thank my lucky stars all the time that we have that privilege. You know, it's been great.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's actually something you'll remember us touching on with our guests this week, is just talking about that idea of inequality across different countries. I believe we talked about it whilst we were on air still. And yeah, his perspective was just really fascinating, hearing about the comparison in different countries and how this has spread. Great to get, like you said, his perspective on PTSD and the additional factors that will play into that from COVID. And to give you some more background on our guest, Dr. Hasseltine is well known for his pioneering work on cancer, HIV and AIDS and genomics, and has been making regular appearances throughout this whole period on channels like MSNBC, CNN, Bloomberg, here in the UK on the BBC, and so many other news outlets, giving his perspective as someone that has been very involved in the science around tracking the pandemic. So with that all said, we hope you find this episode as fascinating as we did, and we'll be back in a moment with Dr. William Hasseltine. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello, I'm Bill Hasseltine, speaking to you from Connecticut this morning. And I think the first thing to talk about, that I've been asked to talk about, is when has been my first contact with issues of mental health. I have to say it started, unfortunately, very early on. My family has the unfortunate affliction of bipolar disorder. Now, I've been lucky, I've been spared, but many members of my immediate family and more distant family have not been so lucky. And I've lived with the consequences of people very close to me suffering from bipolar disorder, either treated or not treated. And that has sensitized me to the whole idea of mental health, as I say, from a very young age. It's one of the reasons I decided to take up a career in health. At first, I thought I'd be a psychiatrist. I'm now not a psychiatrist. I've been a scientist, a businessman, a philanthropist, a lot of other things, but I've always been interested in mental health from a very, very young age. Let me say something about mental health that I think most people who haven't had the kind of experience I have don't quite realize. And that is, we have encountered somebody with a serious mental health issue. Our first tendency is to try to squeeze them back into what's normal. And unless you experience it and you really live with it and you understand it, it's very hard to know what it is you're witnessing, what it is you're seeing, how to relate to it, and how to get help. And one of the reasons I wrote Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder Related to COVID is because our whole society is under stress. We're all undergoing mental stress. Some of us will have pre-existing conditions which are exacerbated by the stress of COVID. Some people will experience it really for the first time. But we're undergoing a really societal, global stress of an extraordinary nature. And it is manifest. And that's why I wrote the book, What It Is, What We Can Do About It.
And I just want to draw back a little bit to those early experiences you shared around mental illness in family members. And was that something that was openly discussed at the time? What level of understanding did you have at that point?
Well, you know, it sort of gradually, as I grew up, you know, going from a 3-, 4-, or 5-year-old, 6-year-old, 7-year-old, I was so stressed as a young kid. People thought I was stupid. In fact, I behaved functionally stupid. I can tell you what stupid feels like. It feels like you don't understand what's happening around you. People will tell you to do something, you won't understand what they've said. And so I barely passed through my early first, second, third, fourth grade. I almost flunked, almost didn't get to go to fifth grade. But in fifth grade, I discovered I could read and I sort of escaped. So I was in such pressure. But you asked me very specifically, when did I realize the kind of pressure I was under? And I think it was probably in my junior high. That's about 11 to 13, 14 years old. When it became inescapably clear when people close to me would be institutionalized, that's what it was about. And then later it became, as I was in high school and during high school, very openly discussed what the role of psychiatrists were, what the role of mental institutions were. So it was inescapable and it was part of a very open discussion. And then later I came to understand it was, you know, a member not only of my family, but of families that were related to us. And up to 1/3 to 1/2 of all those members of the family had the same kind of issues. Now, bipolar is an interesting because sometimes they're either catatonic, so depressed they can't speak, and sometimes they are hyper, and there's all sorts of continuums in between. And the thing that people don't really understand is how fast that can change from depressed to hyper. It doesn't affect everybody exactly the same way either. Even in the same family, there are many differences in the way it manifests. And so that became very clear to me. And, you know, when you deal with it firsthand, it's sort of a day-to-day battle, not my own personal battle, but battle with people very close to me. And it's something that just never lets up. It's there every minute of every day.
Right. And it can lead to, I would imagine, a lot of turbulence in your young life.
Well, the worst thing that happens is suicides. And most of you, it's a life-changing event. Because untreated, it's a very serious affliction, very serious disease. And the problem is people don't recognize it as a disease because it's not physical. I actually explored that very carefully when I tried to understand that. And I worked in a state mental hospital. I volunteered as a graduate student at Harvard in a state mental hospital. And I took a while to try to understand that. That mental illness is a disease as serious as cancer or any other disease that can be lethal if it's not recognized and treated.
Right. Well, absolutely. And that's why we make sure to talk about that week to week and have our particular focus on stigma, because so much of that comes from people not understanding those differences. Because so often we react badly to what's different. And so I took you back there a little bit to those earlier experiences, and now we'll move back to where you were talking about COVID PTSD and what you've seen as someone who's followed the COVID pandemic very closely and been someone that's been an authority called on by all kinds of media outlets, including here in the UK. And so what have you seen throughout the pandemic in terms of potential symptoms that would necessitate a new diagnosis of COVID PTSD?
First of all, let's talk about post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. And until about 1980, people didn't even want to recognize it. It just wasn't recognized as a treatable disorder. And so people call it shell shock, battle fatigue, malingering. they would sometimes execute people because they were thought they were shirking their duty in time of war. So it was very late that we recognized that one of the constants, it was really the Vietnam War in America that did it for our country, that there were so many people who had experienced traumatic experiences, witnesses to essentially war crimes committed, innocent people saw all sorts of horrible things, and they came back. And they were really disturbed and manifest as anxiety. That's one of the first things. You're really anxious. You know, I have a brother who was in the Iraqi war. He was a senior intelligence officer. He was living with me for 6 years between marriages. And we lived together, and I actually watched what happened to him. And he was about a, you know, put together guy as you could get, very brilliant, doing work at a very high level, super, you know, whatever grades they have. He was like a very senior multi-star general and equivalent. But when we were driving around Washington, I was living in Washington at the time, there would be a noise and he would duck. He was so traumatized, but he had a really serious kind of breakdown as a result of that. So I had watched that happen firsthand with that war. But then when I was thinking about COVID and watching COVID, you know, I had a ringside seat to COVID from very early on. I was in Wuhan in November of 2019. I was there because I'm the head of the U.S.-China Health Summit. We held our meeting there. I came back with a dreadful cold. I don't think it was COVID because I tested negative. But I can tell you, I have lots of friends in Wuhan. A lot of people work for my office in China. And so I was witnessing it firsthand. One of our employees lost three grandparents in 3 weeks in January to COVID. Wow. So I could see the impact right there. I remember talking to him about his uncles who were standing in line for hours, 18 hours to get tested. And they got COVID standing in line. Okay. Oh. And when the whole place shut down, it was dramatic. And I saw the power of this pandemic from the very first moment. That means the last week of December, the early weeks of January. And at first I told my friend, like many people, we try to dismiss things. So it's just like the flu. He said, Bill, this is not the flu. Get that out of your mind. This is not the flu. This is deadly serious. What's going on is not the flu, please. And that, you know, had me look at it much more closely. And I've followed it ever since. But let me talk about trauma in a couple of ways. Trauma has something happening to you. And there are terrible things that happen to people when you lose people close to you. You yourself may get sick and barely survive, or your husband or your wife or your child may be intubated and you can't even see them as they go through the extremis and die. That's traumatic. So there's direct experience that happens to you. But when you see trauma all around you, that's traumatic too. But there's a special kind of trauma I've written about. It's called moral injury. People in this epidemic have been morally injured. Now, normally that's confined to soldiers who are ordered to do something horrible. But it also happens when you see people in authority doing things they shouldn't do. And we, throughout the pandemic in many, many countries, also suffer moral injury. And doctors and nurses suffer moral injury. They know they're not given the equipment that they need to protect themselves and to treat their patients. We know, especially in America, that our government denied what was going on, minimized the pandemic, told us we should take drugs that everybody said were poisonous or certainly didn't work, and it's still going on. So there's a moral injury, which is part of this definition of COVID-related post-traumatic stress disorder, which is part of what's going on in all wars, you know? And I've done research now on moral injury. That goes right back to the Greeks. And certainly earlier, people recognize in times of war, people are called on to do things which are morally repugnant under any other circumstance. But even in that situation, there's things you should not do.
I just want to pause on that actually around moral injury. And in particular, I think what has been so difficult for many people to wrap their head around is the newness of this danger. That whilst there can be many similarities with other viruses in the past, the majority of us have never lived through something like this. And so there was a necessary amount of encouraging fear so people would take this seriously and abide by the health guidance and the restrictions put in place. But does then that add to that in a way that people have this moral quandary of being encouraged to look out for others because of the risk that they could harm them by passing on this virus. And then that becomes like an additional mental load of, could I have harmed anybody and not know about it?
Let me make it very specific for the UK and the US. You will recall there was a time when your government talked about herd immunity, and that's where we should get to. So we should just let this virus roll. That is seriously, morally unjustified. It's really saying we're going to let X millions of people die and not do anything about it. That's murder. That's knowledgeable. They know they should do something. They choose not to do it. That is a good definition of, if it's not first degree murder, it's some kind of homicide or manslaughter. It is killing your fellow humans through inaction. And that is horrible to witness. And we don't talk about that trauma so much. We don't talk about the trauma that people are having right now with people putting their fist in each other's face over masks and somebody screaming at you. Or the kid I saw on television the other day was talking about losing his grandparent to COVID, and he was being ridiculed and jeered at by parents in the school. That's a moral trauma for that kid. And it should be a moral trauma for anybody who sees it. So in this particular COVID, there is real trauma that we experience, and there is moral trauma, and there is societal trauma. And what are the symptoms? They're anxiety, and you measure it off the charts in most countries. There's depression off the charts in most countries. There is interfamily violence, which is higher than it has been. There's suicidal ideation and suicide. Now, it's interesting. The suicides have not gone up so much in this particular case. There is a lot of suicidal ideation, but it's not really gotten to that. But all of the other disturbances, drug abuse has skyrocketed, whether it's alcohol or opiates or other kinds of drug abuse. And it's affected a group of people which are normally buffered, which are children. When you look at the numbers for children that are expressing various symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, depression, and then acting out, it's affected a very large group of people. And now that they're going back to school, they've got to cope with it. So the first part is, I think the message, and I'm glad we're speaking about this, is to get the message out that this is a societal mental health problem, that this isn't normal. We're going through a stress that is not normal, and there are going to be serious reactions. And the first thing is to do is to diagnose that something's going on. And that, hopefully, leads to some action to do something about it.
For sure. And very much a similarity, I think, in how healthcare works, both in this country and in the States, is because we lead with a diagnostics model, you, in most cases, need a diagnosis in order to access treatment. And so what elements do you see that are distinctive to what could be COVID PTSD beyond what PTSD currently encompasses?
Well, as you have properly said, in order to be treated, and in this country to get paid for treatment, okay, mm-hmm. because that's a bigger issue in the United States. If there's no diagnostic code, there's no payment. So what will qualify? Well, if somebody comes in and they're anxious and they're rather if that person hasn't been in a terrible car accident, if that person hasn't been in a war, you might not be able to write down that code if somebody may question that for payment, because insurance companies in the U.S. are always questioning, is that really a justifiable code? And you can see why, because they have to pay. And if we don't include the kind of stress that you experience during the pandemic, whether there are people close to you dying, whether you're just hypersensitive to the trauma that's around you, whether you are just completely horrified by the inaction your government has taken, those should all qualify for a diagnostic inclusion in post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, there's another problem with calling this post-traumatic stress disorder, because we're not out of the stress. We're in the middle of the stress. So post should be in quotation marks. We are under stress right now. Think, you know, in the United States, we have more people overflowing our hospitals in the South than we ever had before. We're going to something called crisis standards of care. That's happening right now, crisis standards of care. And I've written about it before during the last epidemic where we were turning away patients. We're certainly at that. But right now, I was just reading in Utah, no elective surgeries, none, canceled. That is not good. Or maybe I got it wrong. Maybe it's Colorado. But one of those states has now canceled all elective surgeries. And maybe pretty soon they're going to have to cancel other surgeries too, because there's just no more room at the hospital. That is a real crisis that those healthcare workers are going through. There's a wonderful book that was written by a British nurse about moral trauma, what she's gone through, being asked to go to the front lines again and again and again without the proper support. So part of this book is a call for what to do about it, to treat. But let's, in hospitals, make sure our healthcare workers who are out there getting traumatized every day have at least the support, and they have the extra personnel and they have some time off to cool down. But you can't go through trauma every single day like these healthcare workers are doing and not have tremendous consequence. Same now with our kids. We're sending our kids back to school. There's going to be a lot of behavioral issues that are already showing up. And the staff, it just is either not prepared or doesn't have extra staff to take care of. We need extra support for our teachers and our school administrators. They can't handle it all. There's going to be a lot of issues of kids. Some are going to be totally withdrawn, and some are going to be the extreme opposite and totally aggressive. And they're going to be, and already there are reports that there are more kids like that than there were before. It's not every kid in the world is happy to go back to school. Some are really traumatized, and some are absolutely terrified to go back to school. And you can understand, if they've been kept aside, why that is. So there's so many issues that if we recognize what's going on, we can begin to do something about it.
Absolutely. And am I right in understanding then that your pitch for this would be to broaden the diagnostic capabilities of PTSD currently, or would it be to have a separate diagnosis specifically for COVID PTSD?
It's much easier to broaden the current definition than to get something new. So I would like included in the entry criteria for consideration the current experience that many people are going through. Did you have COVID yourself? Did you have people close to your family who had COVID? What is your attitude toward measures which are taken, protective measures? And there has to be, let's take the other side of this. There are COVID deniers, and there are people who don't think they should take the vaccine. And they can be equally traumatized by people who are forcing them to do things they don't think they should be doing. Now, I think what we have to do is take a much broader and more sympathetic attitude, not from a societal point of view, but from a medical point of view, because they may be just as concerned as people are about inaction, about action. And when it comes to mental health, you can't discriminate on the basis of what their political belief might be. You have to treat them for the disease that they've got. And I think there are many people on that part of the society which truly believe this is a conspiracy. They truly believe there's evil planned and going to be done to them. That's going to create trauma on that side, and we have to be sympathetic, not to their point of view, but to them as a human being in trouble.
Right. I think that's very important. And you've talked about certain groupings in society and how their experiences differ. So would you see potentially, if it was a young child or other young person, a healthcare worker, someone in the general population, an adult, would you see different elements of diagnosability to match those different groups and how those experiences are?
It's a complicated question. My expertise doesn't go deep enough to answer that question. But, you asked about personal experience. I lived through polio. I didn't get it myself, but I was a kid that had many of the same restrictions that our children are now experiencing. You can't have more than two friends over at a time. You can't go to the swimming pool in the hot summer. You can't go to a movie theater. You can't be in crowds. There's something out there coming to get you. And as a kid, I can remember, and remember, I was kind of a stupid kid. I was really upset, very, very upset. What's going on? I don't know what's going on. Why can't I do these things? Nobody came to me and said, you're upset. We want you to calm down. But these are real traumas for kids. And because you don't fully understand what's happening, there's a sort of a veil put over things. You don't understand necessarily what a virus is. You just understand the immediate barrier. Your life has changed. And I remember how that felt. It was, why can't I do these things? What is it? Is it me? Is what's going on in the outside world that has changed my life so much? I don't know if you could say I was traumatized, but I was really upset during those polio summers, I can remember. And I was so relieved when in junior high we got the polio vaccine.
I can imagine. And that's something that I'm very passionate about, us not underestimating how much kids pick up. Because whether you understand what's happening or not, you can feel the fear. And particularly at a time like this,
you're very, very sensitive to your parents. And when the parents are fearful, which they are, and you can feel that, you know something's really wrong. And you just don't know exactly what it is. And I can still recall that feeling. It's a very bad feeling. Even thinking about it gives me the shivers. It's a bad feeling.
And so as someone that has been following the pandemic so closely and researching it, what do you see will be coming next for us in terms of how successful the vaccine rollouts are going in our two countries, but also more broadly, how that's going to help globally? And how would you see the impact the mental health crisis as well?
Let me sort of take it from a broader perspective. I've started writing about multimodal COVID control. And so you need multiple layers of protection. Suppose you're like in a castle and you're the last person in the castle keep, right? And you want to be safe. Well, you first want to know what's going on out there in the world. You need spies and you need to know intelligence. What's happening? That's surveillance, which we failed at pretty miserably. Then it's in somebody's country. You have to know really what's going on there, what they're doing, and do your best so it doesn't come to you. We failed at that pretty badly. We knew what was happening in China. I saw what was happening in China. And we didn't do really anything to stop it. Eventually put in some sloppy border control, but whammo, it's way, way too late. Next thing you do is you say, let's try to do what we can to protect ourselves through behavior change. There, we really failed and failed today. And that's where society has to go. It's how we moderate our own personal behavior and societal behavior when faced with a mortal threat. Now, the Chinese did everything right from what I see from like month two, three on. The first month was a mess. But after that, they did exactly what our test books say. Test, contact trace, and isolate, and control your borders. That's in every public health textbook. We at Harvard School of Public Health, where I was part of, helped train them. The group, specific group I'm head of, the U.S.-China Healthcare Forum, was designed to help train at Harvard School of Public Health the leadership of public health in China, and we did it, and they just followed the textbooks. Exactly. We have not, and don't do it today. New Zealand, they do it. They've tried in Australia, and they do it pretty well. But if you don't have that kind of protection, then you rely on vaccines. Think of it as a moat around your castle. They're already there at your wall. And finally, of course, in the castle keep, there's all these new therapies. And fortunately, that's working better than it was before. But if you don't take a global view of this, look what happens in China. China's doing what they can do with public health and now with vaccines. But every so often, they'll have to shut down 200 million people, Shenzhen all the way to Macau. That's 200 million people. By the way, that's like the biggest port in the world. So you can't get your goodies for Christmas. Same thing with Ningbo. It got shut down. The biggest port there, second biggest port in the world. Part of it shut down because of COVID. And so it goes around the country. I talked to my team in China. Okay, how is it today? Well, there's a few cases in China. In Shanghai today, they've closed it down. We can't travel to Beijing. Oh, everything's fine now. We can go to Beijing back and forth. We can go everywhere we want, except we can't go to X, Y, or Z. So they have got it pretty much under control, but only through massive, massive efforts. And it's going to have an effect. You can't go to China unless you're going to spend 2 weeks in a hotel. You can't do it. And it's kept them. That's unbelievable. Look at us, 650 million people dead or more. Well, humans can do it. We need to do it as our really major line of defense. I don't know. Is it a moral trauma to see that it can be done and know your country isn't doing it? For me, it is. I don't know about others.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. And you mentioned earlier how it's tricky even to talk about this in terms of PTSD because the post element of that term we have not yet reached. So in lieu of there being any solution that is going to create perfect eradication, that's not what we're aiming for. Where would you see us needing to get to in order to lessen the impact on mental health? Is there a position you could describe that we could get to globally in combating this and have enough measures and suppression in place that the mental health impact significantly?
Yeah, I would say the people of New Zealand and the people of China, they have COVID amidst their midst occasionally, but it's for a tweak. It's a short period. You know, one of the things that makes COVID so dreadful for us is it just goes on and on and on. And if you think of this summer, for a very short moment, you thought, I could breathe easy. Now, I didn't breathe easy, but most everybody else did. Okay, I saw what was coming next. But most people were breathing easy and saying, okay, now it's going to be over. And then it shut down again, and then it's come back. And that is, you know, we can stand some things, but then it's like, I think that poem, I regain my freedom with a sigh. If we get used to being in this and all of a sudden it's relieved and then whammo, they shut it down again. That's traumatic. So I'm confident that over time, human beings will live with this. We'll adjust our behavior where it means meeting masks in the winter, whether it means getting ourselves tested more frequently, whether it means getting jabbed every 6 months, we will do it. I have to say, when I think of my own life, I think we have to undergo a different relationship to nature. And we have to be sensitive to the rumblings of nature, whether it's our atmosphere, our seas, or our diseases. It's a different kind of mentality than we've had in the post-war. And if you look back, pre-antibiotic, pre-vaccine times, you see that people had a different attitude. And even in those countries, whereas hygiene is not universal, you see everybody is much more careful in their personal behavior than they are in countries that are so-called hygienic. They're very careful to wash their hands. They're very careful to wash their vegetables. They're much more dirt averse, for one thing, but they're also much more disease averse. And those are sort of deep cultural patterns. Absorb the new reality and absorb those cultural patterns as part of our life.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And we will start wrapping up there then. So you've written about this so much more extensively in your book. Could you share a little bit about that and where people could find it?
Right. It's a book called COVID-Related Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, CVPTSD. It's available on Amazon. It's available as an ebook, and it's available as print on demand. Also, I've created this genre I call a living ebook. And that means if you buy one copy, you get all subsequent editions for free. And in many of the books I've written, for example, Variants, the Shape-Shifting Challenge of COVID-19, what I've done with that is I've updated, I think, 3 or 4 times now. And if you bought one copy, you get all the updates free. It's kind of like Wikipedia. Once you get it, it keeps updating all the time. I would recommend it if you are thinking about the stress that you or your family is under, if you're in a position where you might be able to help the healthcare system recognize the stress that people are under and the consequences. I wrote it for both policymakers and for everybody who's going through this experience.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. And I definitely recommend our listeners check out your book because you've written so many and therefore, like you said, a range of different backgrounds. In particular, I took a look at the family guide for COVID you designed. Right. And I thought that was really impressive, an accessible way of having up-to-date information to protect your family.
And you get to see some of my grandchildren in that book. The pictures of those kids, many of them are my grandchildren.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for talking to us today and best of luck with your work.
Well, thank you. And thank you. I want to thank you all for your great program. This is a really important topic. And just keep up the great work. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.